up, everybody? Welcome. This is the 46th episode of Mic Check, a slightly delayed episode this week. I'm supposed to do it Thursday, but I'm here with my friend that I met on Twitter this year, Based Meth Addict, who is a Palestinian living in America. Doxed. I just doxed you bad, bro. You just got doxed.
So over.
Yeah, it's over. It's over. So, yeah, we just sort of have been tweeting back and forth and on the kind of the same page with stuff on Twitter. So I was like, just message you. I was like, hey, you know, you want to come on and talk about it a little bit if you're not worried about it. But so if you real quick just want to introduce yourself a little bit, you know, whatever you're comfortable with putting out there, you know, obviously you can't reveal certain like where you live and stuff like that. But yeah.
I mean, what's it called? So I was born in America. My parents are Palestinian. Both families are from Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. Born and raised here. I live in the West Coast. I lived in Jordan, and I several times for a year. And I, when I was younger, and no, I'm just here, just doing my thing. Yeah. I tweet on Twitter about the conflict and about you know, just what's happening in Gaza, the Jewish control of American, basic, yeah, European politics.
So I talk you're about cutting in just a little. You're cutting in and out just a little bit. I don't know if you have a gate set on your audio or something, or I don't know what it is.
I don't think I do.
Okay, well, if I'll try and hopefully ignore it. I don't know if it's. I don't think it's on my end, so hopefully it's not so bad.
Let's see. Well, hopefully it's the how about now? How is it now? Is it fine?
Yeah, you're fine. You're fine.
Yeah. Okay. But no, the I tweet about that, and I also just tweet and about what's happening in Syria, you know, just the,
yeah,
the continuation of the century of the humiliation for turn into a second century. You got to love that. You love to see it, don't you?
Yeah. You know, hopefully our audio levels are pretty equal here. People usually kvetch, but if they aren't, whatever, I'll figure it out. Anyway, yeah, no, so the Syria thing, I mean, we're like jumping way ahead because we said we were going to give like a history, but that was to me very devastating because, you know, I was just like, I was very much like when that happened, because I was like, okay, this is a big problem. Like this, whatever. I know a lot of people didn't like Assad. I mean, I did. There was the memes. Everybody loved the Assad memes. They were great. But like, I sometimes hear from people in the Middle East, from Arabs or Muslims or whatever, they're like, oh, but he still was pretty bad. And I'm like, yeah, but dude, like,
well Assad, like the thing is like, because I know people who left in 2011. Because that's when the civil war itself started, before the protests against him started. People who were active in the trying to work with the government to create the reforms that a lot of the young people did want. Mm-hmm. But the problem was is that, you know, the Jews in the State Department saw an opportunity to basically destroy Syria. And that what happened in Syria is, I guess I'll basically say this about it, and we'll get back to what we want to talk about. What happened in Syria is part of a long-term strategy of, mm-hmm, you know, Israel, of destroying and, yeah, breaking up the Middle East into, mm-hmm, tribes with flags. And it's I'm just going to be the say it. I mean, like, as an Arab, it's – excuse me. As an Arab, it is humiliating.
Yeah.
Humiliating to see Arabs kill each other like this and, like – you know, because at first we were all coping and seething as like, oh, the Arabs, it's all mostly these Turkic, you know, these Uyghurs and Uzbeks and Chechens. It's like,
oh, yeah.
Yeah. We were coping. It's like, yeah, they're doing some of it, but especially the stuff that's happening, you know, with the Druze, it's the Arabs. I mean, like, it's Arabs killing each other, right? Literally, because it's the Bedouins in Sweda against the Arab Druze, and at some point, I don't know. I mean, like, I'm at a point where I've basically just raised, and it's like the only hope I think that the Middle East has and that Arabs have is to get their shit together here in America.
Yeah.
And to create the kind of social institutions, political institutions necessary to combat Jewish power and to basically do, like, our own version of Zionism, but,
mm-hmm,
shut up, we're trying to go back home.
Right. No. I mean, the thing is, I totally get that. And as a white person, the humiliation, the thing you're thinking about, feeling humiliation about this, is like, think about how I feel, right? How we feel, like, you know, from my perspective, you know, when Germany fell, like, that was the sort of the beginning of the end. It was like, now that started the long, slow destruction of our civilization, which coincided with the rise of the Jews. I mean, they were obviously powerful before, but that was when they really just took over everything. And of course, then 3 years later, they create their phony little state. But not that they weren't there long before, because they were there before that, as we know, others might not know.
Yeah.
It didn't just pop up out of nowhere in 1948. There was Jews there before.
And so I guess you wanted to.
But yeah, I'm just saying I can relate to the humiliation thing, because I look at America, I look at Europe. And I think that's why people like kind of look at Russia, because like it's the only white majority country that is actually doing anything at all, and everyone else is just a Zog slave, and it's fucking pathetic, and it's just ugly. And you look around at like the way the Jews manipulate opinion in America, and the way they play liberals and conservatives, and the way they, and it's just a disgusting farce, and it's humiliating. But, you know, so I can relate to that.
Like, I think what's frustrating is just, like, I'll talk to, like, because I've been to Europe a couple times, and I'll talk to, like, you know, you're, like, and I'm just trying to figure out, what are you doing? Like, why are you, like, listen, I'm a T-50 brownoid, and I'm sitting here, and I'm telling you, you don't want 50 trillion of us in your fucking country.
Right.
You know, like, I mean, it's not good for you, in the same way that it wasn't good for us when came into my country.
Well, like, it's sort of funny, you know, McNabb likes to talk about how he'll troll like the rightoids and such, like the dumb conservatives. He lives down in a rural town in Virginia, so he's got a lot of dumb conservatives around him. And whenever the topic comes up, he'll just take the Palestine side. Like, well, you know, wouldn't you fight for your home? Like, wouldn't you, if like a bunch of foreign invaders came and said they're gonna, that's their country now, wouldn't you, like, what are you talking about? Like, how are you siding with the Jews? And then he just like silences them. They can't, but they also don't know anything, right? They don't know enough to have an argument.
They don't understand it. And so I guess this works to get into the actual history and starting back. Like, I know we could be into hours for this, but I'm gonna do my best to size it up, because I think a lot of people, and even on the right, they really just don't get like what was really going on leading up to 1948.
Right.
A lot of people, they know Israel exists in 1948.
Right.
And the Arabs don't like that. They want to kill them. Or even like a lot of like people, right? That's the Zionists. That's the, like, you go, the Jews create Israel, the Arabs
just for no reason.
No reason. All of a sudden,
no rational reason whatsoever. Yeah.
Or even the pro-Palestinians, they don't get, they know that 1948 is when the Nakba, which is Arabic for catastrophe, happens, but they don't really understand what was going on.
Well,
excuse me, in the decades before.
One of the most annoying things, trends I see, is when you get these right-wing or Zionist, really, I don't know, Zionist influencers or commentators that go out and they like to do street interviews and ambush interviews and such. And they go to the protest and they'll grab like college kids. They try and grab like a dumb girl who's doing it for clout and popularity, or she's just doing like the latest activist thing to be cool or whatever, which I don't really care. Like, if that's like, if girls are doing that, like, that's fine. But they're purposely doing this to like humiliate people, right? And then they're like,
yeah,
who was the first president of Palestine? And it's like, bro, like, that question alone is retarded. Like, but
yes, I don't know. 1988 when he declared
you could say yes, that is, but see, their whole point is that's later on, right? But like
my whole point is that if you really want to get into it, you really want to be a pedantic asshole about it, you could say the first king of Palestine was Zahar in the mid 18th century when he rebelled against the Ottomans, built a petty kingdom that went from Gaza to Beirut,
right? So you probably would know more about that, because I don't know much before like the mandate period in terms of the region, but
to get into it, a lot of people, like, I think what a lot of people need to understand is that the real starting point for a lot of this, a lot of people say 1948 because that's when the violence really breaks out and everything is formalized. But if you really want to get into it, you have to talk about World War I.
Yep.
You have to talk about the Arab Revolt. You have to during World War One, and you have to talk about. I would say you'd also just have to talk about the formation of nationalism in Europe in the late 19th century, and how Jews decided they wanted to get in on it,
Well, I would
with
also
the
say what you have to talk about is Jewish emancipation. You have to
Yes,
talk
yes.
about Jewish emancipation from the ghettos in Europe and entering into mainstream political and public life in Europe and being able to. Now, of course, Jewish oppression has always been overstated. The idea they couldn't own land and things like this is largely overstated, but there were in traditional
There were
societies.
restrictions on the kind of land and the
There
amount of
was,
land that they could
yes,
own,
and
but they could own so they like I mean the shtetl. Listen, I tell people this: by the end of the day, the Jews were put in the Pale of Settlement for a reason. They were put in the shtetls for a reason. Now, in the 1860s, this coincided in Russia with the occupation of the serfs, and I think it was Alexander the. It's called like that. Tsar Alexander the First emancipates the serfs in the 1860s, and that's when he also begins to emancipate the Jews, as it were. And Jews start flooding the imperial society. They are going to the universities. They're now participating in banking and literature and blah blah blah. And Jews are primary in the left-wing movements that were starting to show up, especially in Russia, whether it was the Bolsheviks or the Bund or the social democratic movements. Jews were at the forefront of all of it. They didn't always found them, but they were always at the forefront of the ways. Now, I think when you and I think of a communist now saying commie stuff, we think it's silly. We think it's dumb. We think it's stupid. Now, you go to any major city and like the revolutionary communists or whatever, like the or even like if you're Bob.
So you said Bob Vakin. You are actually cutting in and out. I don't know what it is. If there's some, it sounds like there's a gate or something like that. Like when you get too
I
loud,
mean
you.
I don't know what that is. Let's see, user settings,
Yeah, maybe
mute,
just
deafen.
see the audio settings in Discord or something like that. I'm not sure. I hate to. I know this isn't pleasant listening for the audience, and this is a
No,
really important
I
conversation.
apologize. That's my fault. Let's see,
I mean, I
input
don't think
device.
it's like bandwidth on my end. It does seem to be something. So yeah, but anyway, I can keep discussing, I think, along this line. So you were talking about Russia. I'm thinking also Western Europe. We can continue with Russia when you once you figure out whatever. Like what, Western Europe.
How is it now?
I mean, it's okay now. We'll just see if it happens again. So keep going with what you were saying.
So essentially what happened is that they're being emancipated, they're playing roles in these revolutionary movements, and I think we forget that what is silly and dumb to us now, back when these revolutionary movements started, were quite that revolutionary and shocking to society. You had these mostly Jews talking about getting rid of the Tsar, getting rid of the church, upending society, and it shocked and offended people. Now, by the time of Tsar Alexander II, there was an assassination attempt on his life, and it was done by a Jewish man. The attempt failed. And then in 1881, there was a second attempt on his life that was successful. He was killed. It was done by multiple people. At least one of them was a Jew. And with that assassination, that's when people in the Pale of Settlement in modern-day Ukraine, Poland, Belarus, the Baltics, Moldova, and so on, that's when they said, okay, we'd had enough. And over the course of 4 years, from 81 to 84, there were a series of pogroms against the shtetls and the ghettos and the Jewish parts of different cities all throughout the empire. You had hundreds of pogroms that, in the course of 4 years, led to the deaths of several thousand people. And it was basically out of that, and I'm just like painting broader strokes because there were other things involved in the creation of Zionism, but that itself was the real big push for, okay, maybe us Jews need to leave, right? Now, I'm not particularly sympathetic to the Jews. Like again, there's a reason why they were put in the shtetls, and there's a reason why every 40, 50 years there's a pogrom against them. I mean, at some point, like, you're kind of bringing this behavior on yourself. And a lot of these Jews during the pogrom started moving
towards the Western Europe. They started moving into America. Some of them started moving into Australia as well and Canada by the millions, actually. So basically what happened in 1881, a giant Jewish bioweapon exploded in the Pale of Settlement and just infected itself throughout the world.
Right.
I would somewhat
disagree with you, though, that Zionism was a reaction to pogroms. Now, I don't know if you should, if you haven't, you should try reading Kevin MacDonald's book. And I've done several interviews with him. He actually was the one that kind of red-pilled me on the idea that the migration of Jews out of the Pale of Settlement into Western Europe and the United States was not necessarily because of anti-Semitism. That's kind of a just-so story. There's really not much actual evidence for that. And that really what it was the Jewish population itself was exploding and there was too much internal competition among Jews. And given that Judaism and Jewish society is very top-down and hierarchical and based on like membership in various, you know, at least it was in traditional shtetl life, very hierarchical, like you were your top rabbi tier. And like all these people carry around with them, they're most of them are probably fake, but they're claimed lineage going back to whatever. And that this is a big important thing. I mean, he's done a whole major study of traditional Judaism. He doesn't buy that. He's like, nah, they were their population was booming, and there was competition amongst themselves, and so then they started migrating out. I also think Zionism started basically as soon as they had the ability to organize politically in Western Europe and really in Western Europe. So I don't even know. I mean, I think I don't buy their stories about how oppressed they were. As we said, I mean, there weren't things that happened to them, but of course they invited it on themselves. And, and back then it was even considered like, it was the funny thing about it is they sold it to European politicians as solving the Jewish question, sort of almost like acknowledging that there's like an issue with them, you know?
For me, it's just like because like the big issue that I have with the stories that come out of like the Kiev and the Odessa pogroms, right? Or the Kivnev pogroms and the stories that are being told of like average people all of a sudden going batshit insane and like literally bayoneting babies and hanging them from rafters.
It's nothing new.
Or like there's this one story I read of like, you know, like this one woman being hung by her ankles and she was pregnant and they ripped the stomach open the pogroms happened and people got the shit kicked out of them and people got killed, right? You know? But like there's a difference between, okay, I'm going to beat the shit out of this guy with a bat, or I'm going to stab him, or I'm going to shoot him, and I'm going to – there's a difference between that and I'm going to engage in purposeful sadistic violence against like children and women that I do not believe actually happened for a second.
And I'm going to tell you this there's a long – there's so many – when you become like kind of a student of Judaism – not in the way they do it, but like in the way I do it. Like when you become a student of their history, when you study them and you look at the history of things they tell themselves, there are motifs that always pop up in these fake stories. And babies being ripped out of wombs is a consistent one. You get it in the Holocaust where they said this so-called Ivan the Terrible who was supposedly a Ukrainian guard at the Treblinka camp was doing this or ripping. They're talking about women with a hat. And there's this thing they have. And I think it comes from the idea of how focused on reproduction and childbirth and like the Jewish seed and the Jewish bloodlines that they are, that the woman with like that baby half hanging out of her womb is like a thing. They always have that. Like there's always a story. They replicated it in talking. And then they, even in Israel in the 80s, when they took Jan Demjanjuk, who was a Ukrainian who they claimed had been a Nazi guard living in America, deported him to Israel on claims of actually being this guy, Ivan the Terrible, who was a made-up character. And then the Jews in Israel all like lined up to accuse him of all this wild, insane shit. They eventually like let him off because I think the Israelis like realized like there was some somebody in Israel, like at the top, was like, "This is, if we execute this guy who's probably innocent, like this is gonna not a good look." When particularly when they all showed up and like said all this weird, lurid crap that's just fake. And
well, that's no, I haven't. You know, I mean, I've been wanting to read Culture of Critique for a while. I just never got around to it. I will at some point. You know, I know that Antelope Hill Publishing does have that book. So,
well, the new edition is going to be coming out soon.
My boy Josh Neal, consider purchasing your products there.
Wow, you're doing the plugs that I don't have to. Yeah, no, definitely go to Antelope Hill.
Listen, I'm not going to – I don't have time for Passover Press, all right? I don't have time for that.
Yeah, Pesach Press.
I'm here at Antelope Hill.
Yeah. Well, yeah, as you call it. Pesach Press, Passover Press or whatever, which is, you know, run by the Jew Lomas, who's Steve Saylor's favorite, like, male model.
Yeah,
they don't have any original works. Antelope Hill has both. They have –
It's basically everything that Bap and his crew has published, and they also republish we're publishing the based Hardy Boys novels, the ones that are like racist.
That's fucking retarded. That's just gay. Like tell me about that. It's just fucking gay.
The whole thing is a scam. The whole thing is we're gonna take the books we think are based, and then we're going to republish them. There's no original content. There's no original culture. No original art coming out of that. Well, like
they're Jewish. Everything's stolen.
Yeah, it's a scam. But getting into it, like I wanted to say is like okay, so Zionism starts. You had like groups like the Belu, the Palestine Pioneers in the 1880s that were the first to try to get there. They go there and they realize that to live in Palestine, you actually have to work, you know, and so a lot of them actually end up dying. The first Aliyah, the first quote unquote dyingers, they die because they don't know how to actually farm.
They don't know how to take care of
themselves. No, you know, they die from some diseases, and you know, like I mean, making a trip like that is risky to begin with. I mean, like, but most of these people have no idea what they're doing, and then you've got you know Theodor Herzl. Austrian-born or German-born, Austrian-born, I'm almost certain, journalist and writer. He's doing journalism during the Dreyfus Affair, and he's convinced that even so-called tolerant France will eventually turn on us. That's when he writes, you know, Der Judenstaat, the Jew state, or you know, the Jewish state.
Everybody should read that, by the way.
Yeah, you should read that.
You should be reading. It's not very long. You can easily.
No, it's not particularly long. But if you notice, one thing I noticed that's really interesting, and this is what if you read like what the Belu were publishing, when they talk about going back, they say the Belu had like these pamphlets about calling Ishmael brother. To them, and maybe the Muslims are our friends, right? In fact, what's his face? It's the Christians, it's the whites, it's the Europeans. They really hate, right? Mm. It's the same thing. Even with, if I'm correct, even with Theodor Herzl. Herzl, he was hoping to purchase land from the Ottoman Empire, thinking that maybe the Ottomans would treat them kindly. Maybe the Muslims, quote unquote, the Muslims would treat us better. It's the Europeans. It's the white Christians that he hates, that they hate, right? Yeah. And you can see their hatred of these people playing out today, especially in Ukraine, with Zelensky getting support from Jews like Newland to create. It's called basically to fight the last bastion of white Christianity in Europe, Russia. And but this is happening. Like, Herzl is one of the primary organizers of Zionism, right? Especially by the 1890s and early 20th century. You know, he helps organize the first Zionist Congress in 1895.
By some narratives, he was sort of just like a pretty boy they put out in front. Like, he was like a front man. He was involved.
He was instrumental in organizing a lot of these conferences, and he did play a lot of work in like organizational logistics. But he never in his life ever went to Palestine. Right. Never went to the Holy Land. Right. Never went.
He was like, Jews operate like this. Like they, well, the interesting thing, the early Zionist movement also was somewhat controversial. In Jewish circles, it was not something that they were all behind, and there is some truth. There is some truth to the claim that, you know, you'll see, like, just like liberal Jews, so-called anti-Zionist Jews, there's some truth to their claim that, like, oh, Zionists like whipping up anti-Semitism. And now, this is all covered also. I mean, I've been saying this for years. There's also covered, if you want to check out Separation and Discontent. He talks about how there is a level of anti-Semitism, which is good for Jews because, again, it keeps them, it maintains their separation from the Gentile society around them. It prevents assimilation. It makes them, it maintains their sense of identity. And again, Jews have a constant ideology of conflict with all other peoples at all times. Just as a funny little aside about this, just as an example, yesterday, that Jew bitch, Bethany Mandel, tweets out that, like, her daughter's Jewish Zionist camp, probably somewhere in the fucking Catskills, I don't know where, like, somewhere in America, Florida, maybe, I don't know where she is. Like, somebody paraglides over the camp, and they have, like, a freak out. Now, they have armed IDF or armed ex-IDF security there, right? And I'm like, that guy is lucky they didn't fucking blow him away. And he is just some white vacation haver, like, you know, fun haver out there, like, paragliding. He's just like some white guy paragliding for fun. He's in the mountains, you know, he's somewhere in the woods.
He's having
a good time. And it's like, he's like, these Jews are like flipping out and like, and so like, this is part of their thing, you know. And just another thing that happened, there was a black shooting at a club last night in Brooklyn because it was in Crown Heights, which Jews also live there. These Jews are out there they're shooting in a Jewish neighborhood. It's like, dude, I'm sorry, like, that's a nightclub at 3 a.m. Like, that was black people who did that. Like, let's be honest about who's doing what, right? And, like, so it's like, you know, but so there's this level of, like, they want, like, there is some, and so the problem is, though, that the answer to that isn't to, like, not be anti-Semitic or not be anti-Jewish, you know what I mean? The answer to that is just, like, okay, well, we need to, like, escalate the anti-Jewishness to a level that's not acceptable to them. Right, like it has to go. It can't just be at this low level, which they find okay. But they did. The argument was made to Jews, like, we can't be in Europe, and the big conflict was like, well, are Jews going to take over Western Europe through communist or socialist, democratic socialist, really communist Bolshevist subversion, or you know, in the West, the capitalist subversion, or are they going to do Zionism and go back to their own homeland? In fact, eventually they're just going to do all of it, right?
Yeah.
But
it's just whatever works best for them. I mean, you can see how Jews abandoned communism and embraced capitalism and neoconservatism in the 60s and 70s. But the
directly correlated with the 67 war, but yeah,
67 and 73, because communism stopped being useful to them. But no, so getting back to it, so Herzl is organizing things like the Jewish National Fund, and he's helping, and him and a bunch of other people, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But he's the big face to it. He's organizing the World Zionist Congress. He is talking to, like, it has to be understood, it's not just the Rothschilds or the Warburgs or the Goldmans or the Lehmans or the Sachs or these other major European and American Jewish banking families.
Although he was talking to them too, though.
Yeah, he was talking to them. He was talking to all of these families that were donating money to them, to the cause. But it was also individual Jews that were donating a couple pennies, a couple pounds. You know, they'd have that big blue 10 box that it's called the Jewish National Fund box. They'd put change in it, and then when it filled up, they would put it, you know, they would send it to their local JNF office. And now what's going on is they're doing that, they're organizing, they're trying to figure out what to do, what not to do. More and more Jews are beginning to trickle into the Holy Land, and the Arabs, they don't really see them as Jews initially. Because they're white looking to them, they're speaking Russian and German and they're speaking French, they're speaking Yiddish, and they're like, okay, well, who are these people? It's like, oh, well, we're Jewish and we want to live here. And some of them are like, okay, but here's like, the Arabs mostly don't even know that they're there because
it took them a while to catch on. Yeah,
what it was is that, and especially in the beginning of the 20th century, they're like buying land and developing far away from it. Right.
Well, I believe that they also purchased land from Ottoman landlords that were not living there.
They did. Yeah. But that's really more in the 20s, yeah, and that's what causes later, a lot of the riots and a lot
that's
of
when
the
That's when the Arabs started catching on, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, but what happened essentially is that they're doing that, and then all of a sudden, World War One starts, right? Now, we can – I don't want to really get into the history of World War One because I think we both know that what we're taught and the reality are two different things.
Yes.
But in terms of how it relates to the Levant, like I think
this
a lot of people really forget that the Levant was one of the most important fronts of World War One.
Yeah,
we
was.
Think of the destruction of France. We think of the destruction in Italy. We think of the mass devastation, the millions that died there. People forget that a third of the population of the Levant died during the First World War from starvation. There was like the famine of Mount Lebanon, from fighting either on the side of the Ottomans or against the Ottomans. I have multiple family great uncles that were conscripted into the Ottoman army in the First World War. One actually evaded. The other tried to evade and was spent his whole war in prison. But several others fought with them. But
and
what's happening?
There's something else that needs to be said about this, which is that this is a thing about like why when white people today, conservatives, usually totally ignorant. You know, usually I'm talking to people, English speakers, whether they're American or UK or sometimes Australian or something like that. Though this isn't our problem. This part of the world is so far. Like, you don't understand the deep history between Europe and the Levant either. Jews there or not. It's not even just that we fund this conflict and we back up Israel. It's also like there is just a long history there, and it does intimately involve
the
war. And Arabs fought for the British, and so when you hear British people talking like, these people, I'm like, you don't know anything. You don't know anything.
Like, you know how little people know
is
that whenever I've spoken to several people in Britain that are around my age, I ask them about T.E. Lawrence. They have no idea who the hell T.E. Lawrence is. They thought he's like some explorer. They know the movie Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah, they might have heard of Lawrence of Arabia. They don't know anything about what it was.
I do not know this. Like, I mean, because this is so integral. What he did was so integral to the First World War. Like, the work he did, like, shaped the course of events of history. Like, I mean, like, this is important. We're not talking about, like, some guy that went into Arabia, converted to Islam. Like, I'm talking about...
No, it wasn't something... I mean, he did LARP a little bit, but he wasn't, like, you know...
I mean, he LARP. He loved Arabs. Like, he was as close to going native as one would while staying loyal to the crown. But, like, this is important. But, no, so World War One starts, and and it's very obvious after a year that... It's obvious that the Germans are likely winning this war. You know, it's not very – people forget. It was not very clear during the war who was going to win. The Germans were fielding a fantastic – I think it's arguable that the Imperial Army during World War One was in certain ways better than the Wehrmacht. I've heard people debate this, but what I am trying to say is that this is a highly competent, highly trained military,
right.
And they're fighting two fronts: the Russians on the east, and the French and the British on the
isn't
west.
Isn't it a tragedy of German history that this is always what happens to them? But anyway, forward.
It is. But what's going on essentially is that. The British are going berserk. More specifically, they are running out of money because besides spending money on their own coffers, they're bankrolling the French. They are borrowing money up the ass from a lot of people. Now here comes, and you have a lot of Zionists that are making threats. They're saying that they're talking to the British. And I'm going to talk about one of them. You have the British have a problem where they can't procure. Something called cordite. Cordite was the gunpowder they used in basically near all their munitions, from rifle cartridges to artillery rounds to the big naval guns, right? And the reason why is because they had a hard time procuring acetone, which was important in the creation of something called cordite. The British, the Ministry of Defense, finds out about this guy named Chaim Weizmann. Weizmann is a biochemist lecturer from Belarus, I think, who moved to America. Moved to the UK, and he was lecturing in the UK. And he had created he found a way to organically synthesize that acetone, right? They talk to him about it. They approach him. He takes the formula. He changes it. He scales it up to mass production. Then boom, almost overnight, Britain's gunpowder problems are solved. Chaim Weizmann is also an ardent Zionist.
Super Zionist, yeah.
Big time Zionist. And now all of a sudden, he's got the ear of the Minister of Defense, the Prime Minister, the Foreign Minister. He's got the ear, and he's in. He has very close relations with some of the most important heads, so-called government ministers, and frankly, and also the Prime Minister in Britain. And he uses his influence to basically get the British to, you know, do what he wants. He wants Palestine. He wants the Jewish state. At the same time, I think this is the Shabbos goy nature of it all, maybe, really, because the British are desperate. I think people really don't get how desperate the British were during this war. They're broke. They're losing men in the front. The Gallipoli campaign failed. Now, and they're trying to deal with the Germans, and they're also trying to deal with the Ottomans. So the British are making deals with the French. They're making deals with the Zionists, and they're making deals with the Arabs, specifically through Lawrence. Lawrence meets with a man named Faisal bin Ali bin Hussein bin Hashim. Mm-hmm. And if the word Hashim or Hashemite means anything to you, it should, because the Hashemite clan is the clan of the Prophet Muhammad. And right. Faisal was a descendant of the Prophet Muhammad. Right. And Faisal and his father Sharif lived in Medina, and they lived under Ottoman rule, right? People forget that the Ottomans controlled all of the Middle East, and either by direct role or through tributary and vassal states, most of Arabia, right?
Yeah.
Which include Medina and Mecca. And the Arabs, for a while, just really did not like being under Ottoman, right? They'd been under Ottoman rule since the 14th, 15th century. They were sick of it. There were two major revolts in modern-day Palestine. One in the 18th century, led by a man, Dahar al-Umar, and another peasants' revolt in the 1840s and 50s started in Gaza, actually, and then spread all throughout, you know, southern Palestine. Both revolts eventually suppressed, but there was just a general discontent. The Arabs of the Levant and the Arabs as a whole, but particularly in the Levant, wanted their independence. Lawrence basically goes to Faisal and says, I will guarantee that you will have independence if you fight for the British, if you revolt against the British. Now,
He means the Ottomans.
Yeah, against the Ottomans. If you revolt against
the British, Ottomans, the British will guarantee ultimately. Yeah. Perfidious Albion strikes again, but yeah, they made a lot of promises.
What's that memory line? The Jew of Europe or something.
Well, it's also just because the Jews, like the Jews have just like a lot of influence in Britain. I mean, you know, it's like there is this Zionist history which does attribute. I'm not saying what you're saying is wrong, but like Chaim Weizmann and Theodor Herzl and these big names of Zionist history and things like that and stuff. But again, you can't leave out the role of the big bankers and the Rothschilds and the Warburgs and such.
Rothschilds. It was a bunch of other Jewish banking families.
There's a lot of them, right? There were several of them.
Yeah.
But you can't leave out the infiltration of Jews into the Western media. Like they were already running the Havas wire agency. They were already running Reuters. In England, okay, that was a Jewish. So when the telegraph was invented, Jews got right out in front of it, and it's like they get out in front. Like it's like I would wonder whether Chaim Weizmann actually invented that or if he just stole it and used it. But like whatever. But they take new technologies that are invented and they see, rather than like adding to it, they find a way to monopolize it for their own good. So, you know, the wire services, the telegraph agencies, like they ran those, so they're running the media. And once they run the media, it's like when you have, you know, the kinds of states that the Europeans were evolving into, like sort of quasi-democratic national states and such, the role of the media became increasingly important. They talked about, all historians talk about the role of the media in World War One being pretty, like, the first time that it played a big role in the conduct of the war, and public opinion played a role in the conduct of the war, and you had nationalism and all these things. So, but Jews were, they were intimately involved in all this. So it's not like there are these big names and such, but just the background, and this would take a lot of more research that I still think needs to be just done on all of this. Like, I don't know all of it myself, but I see how Jews operate today. And I just don't think that, like, there wouldn't have already been just this massive already infrastructure of Jewish power involving media, and particularly media back then, and media and banking. And also propaganda, like they had, you know, the Christian Zionism was the thing in England back then. It's called, it used to be called British Israelism. And it was not exactly the same as how we conceive of Christian Zionism in America today. But nonetheless, it was a vision of Britain has some role, and the Jews absolutely use this. Britain has some role in recreating Israel. And this is some sort of messianic or religious duty that Britain, you know, Britain always has. If it's very funny because they have this whole song, like, talking about British as Britain as the new Jerusalem, like the green and pleasant land, and then there's old Crusader pubs, pubs from the Crusader era. There's like one of the oldest pubs in Britain is like supposedly from the 1100s, called like Ye Old Jerusalem Pub or something like that. You know what I mean? Like, so they had this idea of themselves as sort of like a new Jerusalem to itself. That has more to sort of do with Christianity and things like that. But there was a kind of Christian Zionism, not how we conceive of it in America today, but not so
very different thing. It was British Israelism. Basically, some Brits had – well, British Israelism was part of it. Some Brits had believed that they were the actual lost tribes of Israel for some reason.
Yes, that's sort of like the original Christian identity, you know. Because you still get people today doing that crap.
British Zionism – did have to do of like okay, it's Britain that's destined to help Israel rebuild itself, so we conquer Jerusalem and we bring back
David Jews Lloyd George Britain. Was a big believer in that.
David Lloyd George, I forget his name. He was but he had a whole group of people that were involved in that.
Yeah,
but getting back to the so what's happening is Lawrence is doing his thing. And Faisal believes him. Faisal doesn't have a reason not to believe him.
I mean, Lawrence seemed to have believed himself.
Lawrence, actually, I was while you were saying some of this stuff, I want to quote Lawrence from his book, The Seven Pillars of Wisdom. There's a particular quote that I really like. For my work on the Arab front, I had determined to accept nothing. The cabinet raised the Arabs to fight for us by definite promises of self-government afterwards. Arabs believe in persons, not institutions. They saw in me a free agent of the British government and demanded from me an endorsement of its written promises. So I had to join the conspiracy and, for what my word was worth, assured the men of their reward. In our 2 years' partnership under fire, they grew accustomed to believing me and to think my government, like myself, sincere. In this hope, they performed some fine things. But, of course, instead of being proud of what we did together, I was continually and bitterly ashamed. That's the thing, is that Lawrence himself loved the Arabs, and he wanted them to be independent. But he was ultimately loyal to the crown.
Yeah.
He was he was a captain in the military.
Mm-hmm.
And when Faisal was talking to him, he thought he was talking to Lawrence,
He was talking to some decision maker, too, you know? Yeah.
He thought you have to understand, like, it's not to say that the Arabs are stupid and gullible and naive, but rather the Arabs could not really, based off of just how they dealt with each other with the different tribes and the idea of overtly betraying your allies in that manner, it's shocking.
Well, arguably anybody should find that just terrible, right? Like
it shocked them. It's not something they ever really dealt with. I mean, listen, Arabs obviously lie, and they try, you know, it's in terms of like, okay, we're going to make a deal with this tribe and my tribe, we're making a deal, but we're going to try to, like, you know, argue on the margins and try to closer here. And, well, technically this means that, obviously, right? I mean, that's just what everyone does in terms of, like, you know, negotiating politics like that, as it were, especially between big politics like that. But the idea of overtly betraying your allies in that manner was shameful. No. Shameful in Arab culture.
A lot of British people thought so too. You know, not to totally shit on everyone, because you know he had T. Lawrence had subscribers, and that's sort of where Seven Pillars of Wisdom ultimately was. I think it was like a newsletter that he published for after he got back.
Yeah, it started off as,
and he had supported. He had financials. He had people in Britain that just financially supported him because they. You know, they agreed with what he was saying about how shameful this betrayal of it was. Now, the problem is you have that all the time. See, there's always people in white countries that have these viewpoints, that have viewpoints that we should be honorable. We should keep our word. We shouldn't behave the way we do. Like, you always have a substantial portion of whites that have these ideas. They never get power. I mean, except for, you know, there was a brief period where they did in Germany. But, like, for the, you know, they get boxed out of power. They're, you know, it's just the perfidious Albion, you know, they always end up being the ones that, you know, like the Churchills and people like that, who was an absolute despicable role. Although it's sort of funny because he didn't even really, he was sort of in Egypt just, like, telling, just, like, gas people. He was, like, ordering gassing attacks on... But anyway,
but anyway, so, and what happened is that, so, you know, 1917, they get the Balfour, you know, Lord Balfour, mm-hmm. Balfour Declaration, Balfour Promise. And what happens is that, you know, Faisal hears about this and he goes to the British. He's like, what the frick, bro? Like, what is this? Like, what have you you promised me my own independence. What are you doing promising stuff to these people?
Right.
And they're like, nah, relax, big guy. Listen. Just these Jews want a homeland, blah, blah, blah. But listen, our promises to you are solid and golden. But then, of course, the British are making promises to the French about Syria and Lebanon, right, which was going to be the majority of the kingdom of Syria that Faisal was promised. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of these people, especially at the early beginning, they really believed the British. There's a story I read of Faisal talking to his father, Sharif, and Sharif had actually, he told his father, like, listen, I don't know if I trust these guys. And his father, like, berated him. Like, he dressed him down as, like, how dare you? These are our friends. The British are wise, and the British are powerful. And, of course, mm-hmm. to be powerful like that, you must be wise and trustworthy, right? You know, literally, that's what it was. It's just like, Sharif believed, Faisal wanted to believe, and it's just... It's so sad because you look at video and picture of Faisal during the revolution, you know, during the Arab revolt. He has these – he's very charismatic. He has these quick bird-like movements. I actually think the guy in the movie portrayed him very well.
Omar Sharif was – funny enough, that was the name of the actor that played
him. No, Omar Sharif didn't play Faisal.
Oh, he didn't? Played another. Right. I haven't seen the movie in like 30 years.
The guy that plays Ben Kenobi in Star Wars played the British.
When he played Faisal, I thought he played like some.
No, no, it was Faisal.
That was Alec Guinness. So they had white guys. You want to talk about Alec Guinness? Talk about racism. Talk about like white privilege.
Hey, he kind of looks like him. Like, he kind of does. Yeah. But the Omar Sharif played one of what's his face?
I haven't seen the movie in like 30 years.
Another one of the Arabs.
Let me ask you something about that movie. Because again, I used to like it. I loved that movie when I was a kid. I watched it like several times. And it is genuinely a very good movie. Very interesting. The cinematography, great. And all that's like really majestic.
Beautiful.
But I don't think, I think they kind of skip over the issue of the Balfour Declaration. And the betrayal of is portrayed as happening at the peace conference afterwards, when the Arabs find out, oh, the Europeans are just going to carve up this area amongst themselves and work it out. Yeah,
they make it that they end the movie in a manner they make it look like the reason why the Arabs failed is because they couldn't stop bickering amongst themselves. When the reality is that the tribes had united with Faisal. They had united and pledged their loyalty and their fealty to him. It's like, okay, you're the guy. You are Bani Hashim. You're from the house of Hashim. You are leading us. We're your men, so lead us. The reality is the betrayal. And so what happens is they're fighting, they do great things, they kick Turkish ass. Lawrence probably was not raped by the Turks, though. But he might have been. I mean, they are the Turks, but you never know. Because that's in the book. Because that's in the book. Seven.
There's other stuff in there that's like, you know, some iffy things about him. Maybe a little light in the shoes, but that's neither here nor there, really. But
yeah. But let's go. But what happens is the Allies win, and the Paris Peace Conference happens, and that's and here's the thing: during the peace conference, and I want to pull this up, or actually, it was before the peace conference happened, or the Chaim Weizmann meets with Lord Sokol with Faisal, and I wanna point out Faisal Weizmann agreement, you know, was signed by Emir Faisal, king of the short-lived Kingdom of Hejaz, and Chaim Weizmann, president of the Zionist organization, signed 2 weeks before the start of the Paris Peace Conference. Basically, Weizmann meets with Faisal and basically tells him, "Oh, hey." We just want to be part of your thing, right? When the reality is, you know, the Jews want it all.
It's like lying.
And prelude to the agreement, I want to read. Let's see, signing subsequent. His Royal Highness the Emir Faisal, representing and acting on behalf of the Kingdom of Hejaz, and Dr. Chaim Weizmann, representing and acting on behalf of the Zionist, mindful of the racial kinship and ancient bonds existing between the Arabs and the Jewish people, and realizing that the surest means of working out the consummation of natural aspirations is through the closest possible collaboration in the development of the Arab state in Palestine, and being desirous further of confirming the good understanding which exists between them, have agreed upon the following. They basically talk about developing the land together. See, Faisal is under the impression that these Jews are coming to be his subjects. They're coming to live in his state, right?
Yeah.
But then what happens in 1919 is the Paris Peace Conference happened. Faisal's ready. Okay, I'm ready. Kingdom of Syria. It's real Kingdom of Syria hours. All my niggas, who up? Then yeah. The French and the British say, Lamau, psych. Actually, listen.
Literally, Faisal, psych. I get it. Literally, psychs.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry.
Psychs
terrible pun, but yeah.
Yeah, the British and the French is like, listen, little sandman, little sand monkey. I get it. Your people have fought and died on our behalf for 3 years. You know, hundreds of thousands dead to help us. But you are not ready for self government.
Oh yeah, right. Yeah, right. Yeah, that was. Yeah.
You are stupid and Arab. You know, your physiognomy is not part of the thing and whatever. So what's going to happen is we're going to carve up the Middle East in ways that are not that make no sense to you, but make total strategic and imperial sense to us. And we're going to create these mandate systems under the League of Nations. We're going to help you get ready to create your own state, to create your own nation. How wonderful and kind it is of us. And if you don't agree to this, it's going to be a big and serious problem for you. Now, Faisal is like, oh, God, what the hell do I do? Because here's the thing. Faisal knows he can't fight these people. Listen, the Arabs did well, but the Arabs don't have tanks and planes.
Yeah.
They didn't have tanks and planes. But Faisal says, you know what? I have to do something anyway. He declares the state of Syria, the Kingdom of Syria, which encompassed modern-day Levant, Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, Palestine. And things are chugging along for a year. And what's happening throughout all of this, you have to understand, is that throughout the World War I, Jews are trickling and trickling and trickling and trickling into Palestine, right? Mm-hmm. And now they're causing problems. They treat the locals with severe disrespect. They are open. You have to understand, during this time as well, they're openly talking about, they're marching up and down the streets of Jerusalem and Haifa in, and with weapons and uniforms, talking about taking over the land, right? Mm. And pushing out all the Arabs. And the Arabs are like, whoa, what's going on here? This isn't what we thought you guys wanted. And what happens in 1920 is that there's a riot in Jerusalem called the Bani Musa riot. And the Bani Musa holiday, it hasn't been celebrated since 1948. The Israelis banned it when Israel was created. It's basically a celebration of the prophet Moses in Islam. A lot of many Muslims come from all over Palestine, even greater parts of the Levant, to go to Jerusalem to celebrate. And what happened, and it usually happens sometime around after And what happens is they have the festival, they have the celebration. The British only have like 100 cops in all of Jerusalem, right? Even though that there's this big festival and like they should have more police because the tens of thousands of people came to Jerusalem for this. And there's a riot. No one's entirely sure how the riots – and I'm being serious. No one really – I'd have to – like as far as I can tell, it's not entirely sure how the riot started. But what it was is that the Arabs believe that the Jews are going to attack them on this festival. And something sparks the riot. I'm not – I legitimately do not know what started it. I'm going to find out and, you know, on Twitter I'll post any corrections on that and whatnot. There's a riot. And about a couple dozen Jews die and a couple dozen Arabs die during the riot, right? Literally, equal numbers of Jews and Arabs die during the riot. The Zionists take advantage of this and literally go, oy vey, it was a pogrom. And quite literally, like, it's just like they take advantage of this and they began to demand more protection from the British. They demand more rights. They demand more autonomy and agency. And more importantly, like, what happens is this. Two things happen from this I think are very important. This is where a guy named Vladimir changed his name to Ze'ev Jabotinsky.
Yep.
Makes his rise. After this riot, he creates the Haganah, right? No, excuse me. I apologize. He creates the Irgun, right?
Yeah.
And you also have David Ben-Gurion, who had been active, what's it called, who came to Palestine in 1920, and he creates the Haganah after this, right? Excuse me. Ben-Gurion creates the Haganah after this, and it is right after – excuse me, I apologize.
They were like the liberal Jewish militia.
Chaim Weizmann was a liberal. Chaim Weizmann was a liberal. Ben-Gurion was a socialist, was a socialist, right? And more importantly, what comes out of this riot is that the military governance is replaced with a civilian governance. Now, one thing, to be fair to the British, in particular the British on the ground, when the Mandate of Palestine was created, right? And specifically, this also gave the French an excuse to get rid of the Kingdom of Syria, right? Faisal's short-lived kingdom. The French come in with 10,000 men. Faisal's defense minister, Osman bin something or another, decides, you know what? I'm not going to let Syria fall without a fight, even though I'll die here. Him and 3,000 lightly militia meet the French at Maisalem. The Arabs are defeated swiftly and soundly, and the French march to Damascus and basically create the mandates of Lebanon. And, you know, Palestine is part of this, so create the mandate. What happens is that one of Faisal's brothers, Abdullah, is so pissed off at this that he literally wants to lead an army from Arabia into Syria. It would be which would have been a suicidal attack. Abdullah is told to relax. He's convinced by the British to instead take Jordan, because the mandate of Palestine was literally used to be Jordan and Palestine one together, right? With modern day Jordan being known as Transjordan at the time. But Abdullah is placated by saying, "Listen, we will cut Jordan. We will cut out Jordan and create the Kingdom of Jordan." It's like, fine. Right? This is what pissed off Jabotinsky, because Jabotinsky was a revisionist. He did not want any revisions to the mandate, any revisions to what was supposed to be the Balfour Declaration, and he creates the Irgun. And Jabotinsky is a fascist, right? Yeah. As it were, right? He is a fascist, and that's the thing. Jabotinsky is a fascist, Ben-Gurion is a socialist, and Weizmann is a liberal, really. But they're all Jews, and they're all Zionists, yeah. And no matter how much they all hate each other, and they all did, they never betrayed one another, and they always worked towards the goal. And ultimately boiled down to this. As much as Weizmann and as much as Ben-Gurion would decry Jabotinsky for being a fascist, they always used the Irgun to do their dirty work, right? They had no problem with the Irgun doing their dirty work. Mm-hmm. And reaping the spoils with their hands, speaking out with their mouths.
It's the same shit. Jews do this, right? Like, and we see them do it today. And like the term fascist, we're not like he is a radical Jewish supremacist, you know. And and the thing is, so are the rest of them. They just it's literally, you know. I increasingly don't buy. Now, I understand they have their disagreements and their amongst themselves and strategic fights, and they want to do it one way or the other.
Yeah, but in the end,
I'm sure they personally have hatreds. Like, I know that there are personal hatreds. Like, I know, like, today, like, Yair Lapid hates Benjamin Netanyahu. Like, they hate each other, right? And Yoav Gallant and Netanyahu hate each other, right? But so what? Like, in the end, you know, so, and so, yes, and Jabotinsky, you know, what's very funny is Jabotinsky, this group BTAR, which is on Twitter today, which is talking all about, like, sending all the people from Gaza.
Yeah, BTAR was a group.
That was a youth group. That was Jabotinsky's, that was initially his, like, youth group. And
that was his youth militia, his worldwide, his international youth militia. Right. And they were preparing for war. But then World War II happened.
There's an element of Jewish organization that I still, no matter what, defies any kind of term that you could use for a European political ideology like liberalism, socialism, or fascism, which would be all of it requires. Like, on none of these things are the Jews doing this on the strength of their own people other than their ability to subvert. This is all done with this is all done through subversion of powerful empires that they control through.
Doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what your personal beef is. It doesn't matter what your political beef is. We're all Jews. We're all in this together. We are rivals, not enemies. And that's part of their success.
But yes, that is why. I mean, frankly, this is their strategy. If you want to know more, obviously, Kevin McDonald. Everyone should read it. But it's also like they need the subversion. Like, you talk about, like, the Germans and the Italians, like National Socialism, fascism, right? Like, these are not nations that required subverting another larger empire, that required having agents in another capital, that required running the monetary and banking systems and the media systems of other countries. So no matter what, there's always a globalist, if you will, element of Zionism. Zionism is always a tentacle-like movement. So its manifestation on the ground might look, it sort of like superficially looks like, but the Jews can't do this themselves. Like, if they tried to do like a Jewish Juche or something like that, like self-reliance, they'd be gone. Like, even the Arabs could have beaten them. You know, I mean.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing. The big thing is, like, look at it now. Like, that Israel was so dependent on Arab labor from the West Bank and even from what little was allowed out of the Gaza. But then when they realized that – but then when October 7th happened and they expelled all of the West Bank workers that were working in Israel back in the West Bank, fired them, said they could no longer work, all of a sudden they need labor. Now, they weren't going to do that labor themselves because now they're importing lots of people from India and Southeast Asia.
Bringing in Pajits, man. Bringing in
literally. They're by the tens of thousands. And they have somehow convinced like white Christians to literally – be farm workers for them as part of a spiritual fit. Spend a summer in Israel working on a farm.
Yeah.
You're getting closer to your spiritual roots. It's literally, you're just literally free farm.
That is disgusting. I hate those people. And like Louis Theroux did a video on this. And if we've showed it on our show before, that all these dumbass, like literally retarded, like I'm sorry, like retarded creek shitters from America, just like utterly retarded, dumbass, fucking Christian Zionists. It's they're Boy shameful. Battle. I'm Drop ashamed battle. That these people are white. They're an embarrassment. They are going and they are like so overjoyed to be picking grapes on a vineyard that was stolen from an Arab to begin with, and you know at one point. You know, they're back in the room because when they prepare the wine, right, there's a Jewish thing when they actually ultimately prepare the wine where Gentiles are not allowed to be around there. But they did let Louis Theroux back because he promised he wouldn't touch anything or whatever. They weren't going to let the Christians back there. But they let him back because he was doing an interview. And he is talking to the Jew who's doing some Jew shit over the grapes or whatever that all these Gentiles, all these white Christians had just done picked. And he's like, you know, do they understand? Do you think they understand? There's a political element to this. He's like, they don't know anything about politics. He's like, and he's like laughing at them. the Jew whose plantation it was stolen, yeah. You know, stolen land it was. He's laughing at these idiots and he's like chuckling about it. And Louis Theroux is like, wow, this is like pretty scummy. You know, you're like exploiting these people and they don't even understand that there's a political. They don't even understand on some level that there's a political problem. Here.
Like it's literally, I'm going to get these white people to do free labor for me.
Yes. Now,
that's all it is. And I'm going to convince them that it brings them closer to God.
Yeah.
And which is ridiculous. I'm a Christian myself, a Palestinian Christian, and it's literally the most, and it literally makes me angry both on to see whites and specifically white Christians be abused and used in this manner. I don't have any sympathy for them.
Like, they're scumbags. Like, they should be humiliated. Like, I mean, the thing is, I'll say this, though. They're bad. They actually, a lot of them are very, they're bad people. Because when you do, if they don't understand the politics, if it's explained to them, they'll still just side with the Jews. Because they're retards that are brought up on retarded theology that is actually barbaric and is like trying to be like, I mean, it's disgusting. And I mean, the thing is, at this point, they do know. And if you see the kinds of shit that the Christian Zionists tell them, in America, the kind I'm sure you're familiar with the kind of theology and shit that's preached them. Nah, like, I'm not going to make any apologies for them. Like, and there's plenty of Christians I know that are like, that's not, these are just heretics. Like, this is not, you know what I mean? And I'm fine with that. I'm willing to go with that.
Yeah, I mean, these are just, they're just idiots, but it's just like,
Quick thing about that, sorry, is that I would also argue that I don't know how much labor value Israel gets out of them. I think they get political and propaganda value out of it because
some labor value. I mean, especially because like you have like these ranchers from Montana and Texas that are like doing like, you know, work for them that actually went to Israel and have done work for them. So they're getting their money worth.
Yeah, there is some labor value they're providing, but I think, you know, generally speaking, it's not as like reliable time over time as the, you know, getting just foreign like indentured servants.
I think it's just as reliable because I think these kids really believe that what they're doing is good and righteous.
You got these fucking cowboys going to Israel and blowing on shofars and shit. It's like, dude, like, it's just pathetic.
It's pathetic. But I want to get back to besides the Haganah, besides the Aragon that's created, you know, because, you know, the chopping off of Jordan for the mandate. I think what was most important is the fact that the military government in Palestine was replaced by a civilian government. Now, I want to credit where it's due, and to be fair, the British military on the ground did not like the mandate system. A lot of these officers were pissed off at this whole thing. They fought because they fought alongside the Arabs, and a lot of the ground officers were told, oh, we're helping them against the Turks so they can be free. Now they're told, oh, actually, we're going to rule these people.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, but I fought with these people. I killed with these people. I saw them die. And it's just like, and now, like, to rule them? Why? For a bunch of Jews? Here's the thing. On the ground, a lot of the guys that were in the military were saying, wait a minute. Are these Jews just using us to get their own state?
Yeah.
On the ground, they were thinking this, and there was a lot of just discontent.
I mean,
right?
The Balfour Declaration had been issued. I don't know how well known it was, but yes. But this is, as you said, this is why they replaced it with a civilian thing, because then it would be controlled from London, not controlled by military officers, and it would be susceptible to Jewish control ultimately. Yeah.
And the military did not like this at all. Here's the thing, especially after the Bani Musa riots, and for a while, the military was kind of like, this isn't what we thought it would be. A lot of officers in the military ground were saying, hey, don't do this. This is a bad idea. It's going to piss the Arabs off even more. And I don't even think that anything we're doing here is good for Britain. We should leave. Right. Let the Arabs be free to do what the hell they want, right?
Yeah, and also it was obviously they were empowering these subversive Jews, and they also saw how the Jews were treating the Arabs, and they knew, and they also knew who was really causing the trouble. They knew who was causing the trouble, and they knew political machinations back in Britain to increase immigration rates, to bring more Jews in, which were coming in every year, and whenever they did limit them, it was literally not because they were anti-Semitic, which is now how the fucking Zionists pretend. Like, you don't, like, even when you do a perfidious Albion and you fucking lie and backstab and terrorize and turn your former allies and you stab them in the back and you kill them and you do that on behalf of Jews, the Jews are going to do it to you. They're going to do it to you eventually. You never get rewarded by that. You never get thanked. You always just always a weakness that you helped them. You were gullible. You were stupid. Like being a good guy never fucking pays. Like you could say, well, being a Nazi doesn't pay or being opposed to them doesn't pay, but at least you have your dignity. You know, like, so, like, I would much rather have that.
I'd rather have my dignity and die with
this
gold medal. To get it, and so I want to sort of, like, go forward as quickly as I can from 1921 up until 1948, right? Because there's so much more to talk about. But basically, that happened. The civilian government, the military government is replaced with a civilian government. You have the Jewish agency. I want to say you have the Jewish, which is the in between that coordinates with the Yeshuv, you know, which
That's the settlement, as they call
it. There was no Arab equivalent, right? Mm-hmm. The Arabs were just there, expected to just be there and just do as they're told. There was no equivalent, like where the Arabs could meet with them. And here's the thing: any reports on the ground about how bad things were, especially the commission done after the 1920 riot. And then the commission done after the 1901 riot. Mm-hmm. All those commissions, they go to you, as you call it, every attempt to bring them, all these commissions and reports, and any attempts to bring them to the higher-ups in Parliament and in Westminster Abbey, which I assume their White House or whatever. I think that's what it is, right?
Westminster Abbey was the seat of the Anglican Church.
Oh, excuse me.
You're thinking of just like Parliament.
I'm trying to think of like what
number 10, number 10, maybe. That's the Prime Minister's office.
But basically, we're bringing it to London. These reports get quashed easily, the way on the way.
Of course.
Because the Jews have spies and plants everywhere and bugs everywhere.
They just owned politicians then like they own them today. Not even necessarily pedophiles and stuff like that. Just like they own these people. Herzl himself said he was sometimes amazed at how obsequious European politicians would be to the Jewish cause. He said something like the power of our purse is actually truly fearsome or some quote. Like something along those lines, right?
Yeah.
That he couldn't believe it.
Is that in terms of the average politician, let's just say you're a parliamentarian, right? You're a member of parliament. You don't know jack shit about the Middle East, you know? So you want to know about the Middle East. Who do you go to? Chaim Weizmann.
Right.
Chaim Weizmann tells you about the Middle East, and who are you to tell him no? What?
There's no Arab. Also, no. Even then, you know that if you cross these Jews, the media is going to wreck you. And that was a big deal. The media was a big deal in Britain going all the way back even to the, you know, to the 19th, to the 18th, 19th century. Caught. So you don't want to get savaged in the British media, you know,
you don't want to get savaged by these people that own the media. And also they're the only people telling you anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're like, well, you're thinking, well, I don't know. Chaim has to be right. I mean, who am I to tell him? And if I tell him he's wrong.
And then you have the additional backstop of British Israelism and the religious angle. Yeah. You can present like, oh, the Jews returning home. It's this is a great, wonderful thing we're doing for them. And right.
Who publicly would want to be against that? But there was no Arab equivalent. No. I want to give you like a great example. The best things the Arabs had ever done, I think this is that three Arab delegates had gone to the prime minister or the foreign minister, right? Mm. And they were waiting outside the office. They'd been waiting for hours. Like they prepared this, you know, they had the case they were going to make. And they meet with this one guy. We're here to meet with like the prime minister. Like, why haven't we spoken to him? He's like, oh, well, the prime minister is busy. We had this day. He's like, oh, so here's what happened. The guys going to meet with the prime minister came in wearing regular suits, and they were and the British were expecting them to wear like the typical like robes and stuff, right? Literally, that's what it was. Oh, hey, listen, but it's okay. Prime Minister's busy. He can't see anyone for another trillion months. But here's his top guy on this that you can talk to him and he'll talk to the Prime Minister. Guess who that guy's top guy? Guess who that top guy is?
Chaim Weizmann?
Exactly. Literally. they go to Chaim Weizmann and they are and they try to make the case to him. Right?
This would have been when David Lloyd George was still Prime Minister, or
I'm almost certain. I think it would have been. But so getting back to it, 1921, you have another riot, right? And it's out of this riot. You also have the Erdogan formed and whatnot. Basically, in Haifa, Ben Gurion is out here doing his thing. He's, you know, he's this 5'3", like, you know, curmudgeon-y Jew.
Yeah, really. He really is a weird looking guy. Yeah.
Curmudgeon-y, like 5'3", like, you know, like pissed off, ready to fight dude from Plonsk, right? Like born on the streets, Ashkenazi, ready to basically, like, very nasty person. Typical nasty Ashkenazi Jew, born in the ghetto, born in the streets, in the major cities. Now, but he's a socialist. He's a hardcore socialist. The thing is, however, is that he wants to unite all of the socialists under his labor party. Ahudat Tevrit, he wanted to unite Hebrew labor under his Zionist labor party. And he had a problem with some Jews who were communists, who actually wanted to create, who wanted to build a Soviet state in Palestine for Jews and Arabs equally, right?
Yeah.
There was this growing, I'm not saying it was huge, but there was this growing group of communist Jews who were like, okay, I'm here, my homeland, but there's also these Arabs here. We're going to build this communist state for all the workers in Palestine. It's going to be a Soviet, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Palestine Communist Party at the time. And what happened is that they were meeting up. What happened essentially is that David Ben-Gurion and his group went to confront these communists that were doing a rally. There was a fight. They started fighting each other. The Arabs aren't sure what the hell is going on. They're thinking, it's like, oh, they're thinking that the Jews are getting ready to fight them again. And there's a second riot, right? Same thing. I think about equal number of Jews and I think like 100 Jews and 100 Arabs died. Equal number of Jews and Arabs died. This time around, because in the first riot you had Arabs, some Arabs had gone into Jewish neighborhoods, killed those neighborhoods. This time around, Jews had gone into Arab neighborhoods. There's this one story of an Arab girl, I think she was like 16, 17, having been mutilated, physically mutilated, and sexually assaulted.
Yeah, I can believe that, yeah.
Yeah, an Arab girl. It was an Arab girl. It's just like there is – I am more susceptible to believe the violence on both sides in the Holy Land because this is the Holy Land, right? And there is deep anger and deep hate on this issue, right? So when people say that a group of Arabs like sexually assaulted and murdered this one girl during a riot, right? You know, or during like during violence that's happened, I am more I can believe that happening. I can also believe Jews going to Arabs and doing it to Arabs, right?
But they were always the more nasty ones, man. They've always been nastier. The Jews have always been nastier and shit. They would, you know, they were doing stuff like, I mean, this is a little bit later, you know, like there was one complaint where they talked about Arabs. This is a little bit later. There's one riot in particular where they complained, I think it's like 29, where they complained that the Arabs went into Jewish villages and like pulled people out of houses and killed them. It's like, well, the reason that happened was because the Jew, like, I think it was the Stern gang or maybe the Ergun, one of them, just like throwing hand grenades into lines of Arab laborers lining up to work in, you know, the oil fields or something like that. And they just killed these threw hand grenades into this line. And so, the revenge came later that night when they went into the Jewish towns and they pulled people out and they were killing them. And it's like, well, you deserve that. You fucking earned that shit, you know? Like, that's what you get, you know? So, yeah.
So you have that riot. Things get worse. The Jews get more of what they want because Oy Vey and other. But more importantly, like, this is the 20s is where the land problems become a thing. Now, what a lot of people don't understand is that the vast majority of the Arabs in Palestine, of the Palestinians, are peasants. Specifically, they're effectively serfs.
Yes.
Because the Ottoman Empire had created a series of land reforms that basically – it was, quote, unquote, supposed to be progressive, but the end result is that – some of the richest families and some of the richest people in the Middle East as a whole, and specifically in, like, you know, Beirut and Aleppo and Damascus, they controlled that land, right? And they controlled entire swaths of land that had villages on it. So what would happen is that they would, like, okay, let's sign this contract, you know, mark your X or mark your circle or whatever it is, you Arab that can't, peasant that can't read, but basically it's a contract into perpetuity. I will let you live here. I will let you and this whole village live here as long as you pay rent, right? So long as you pay your rent, right? It was essentially serfs is what they were. They were living as serfs.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fine as much as something like that could be. You know, you plant your fig trees, your olive trees, you plant your oranges, you know, plant, you know, you herd your livestock. You just pay your rent to a guy you've actually never met. You know, most of these people that own the deeds to the land, they never actually been there. For example, like the Sarsuk family, a Christian family out of Beirut, owned like 70 square miles of the Jezreel Valley, which is a valley in the West Bank. And they'd never been there in their lives, ever. But so then what happens is that with the Jewish National Fund, the Jewish National Fund goes to these people and they legally, right? But they are, because they legally buy the land, they're not obliged to honor the contracts that signed, it's called that, that the Arabs had signed with the previous Arab landlords, as it were.
Right.
So they buy the land. Okay, now you have to leave. They're like, what?
Yeah.
You have to go. It's like, what do you mean? I paid my rent. It's like, no, no, no. I'm the new landlord and I don't want you.
Yeah.
It's like, why not? I mean, like, we've lived here literally for generations. Great grandfather planted these trees. It's like, I don't care. You have to leave.
Yep.
And they're like, well, what? Let's. And these are peasants, right? So they're trying to negotiate. It's okay. I'll pay you rent. It'll be just like it always was. I'll take care of this land. You know, nope. Now you've got thousands of people who have lost everything, right? And they're being forced into Haifa. They're being forced into Gaza. They're being forced into Jaffa, which would eventually become, right? And yeah,
eventually become Tel Aviv. You cut out a little bit there. So it's still, it's happening again. I'm not sure what you was
going. Sorry. They're going into Haifa and Jaffa and Gaza, which would eventually become Tel Aviv. And now they're living in these shanties where they're literally putting tarps over sticks, trying to make it. And every day the men go into the city, go to the docks, go past the British and the Jewish part of the city, which looks nice, and they beg these Jews, beg the Brits for work.
Yep.
For in the hopes to get enough lentils just to feed their family. And this is a budding problem that creates like severe resentment. This is part of the resentment that would lead up to the riots of 19, right? And the worst part is that some of these Arabs would go back to, and they would see it fenced out, but then they would see that nobody was on it. The house is dilapidated, right. The trees are dying.
Because they were holding it, waiting for Jews to migrate.
Yeah. There weren't enough, in the 20s, there weren't enough Jews moving in.
Yep.
But and then they would go to the guys like, hey, just let me live here, dude. Like, I'll take care of this place. It'll be just like we always had it. And the Jews like, only Jewish labor.
That's not the point, though. Yeah, that's not the point. Yeah.
Only Jewish labor. And basically, up until 1929, what you have is this big, big kerfuffle. And essentially, the Jews are becoming much and much, much more agitated. They are making it explicit. They want the Arabs gone. They want to destroy the Al-Aqsa Masjid. I don't know if they're talking about rebuilding the Third Temple, but they are talking about getting rid of Al-Aqsa Masjid.
I mean,
they are at that time. I don't know if
this is all like, you know, I don't know how religious or not certain Jews are, but yeah, even those that aren't all that religious, first of all, the society is becoming more retardedly religious, which is inevitable that this would happen, based on sort of the way it was founded and the ideology behind it. But they always wanted to destroy that. And it's not just, also real quick, clear up for everybody. The Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock, there's two important structures up there, right?
Yes.
On the Temple Mount complex.
Yeah.
Which is, one is the mosque and the other is the shrine to where Muhammad supposedly ascended or something like this.
Yes.
So
yes. So the Dome of the Rock is built on what is traditionally called the foundation stone, which Muslims and Jews believe is the stone upon which God built the universe, right?
Right.
That's the foundation stone. They believe that the Dome of the Rock is built on that stone, right? Or what Muslims and Jews believe is that stone, right? It's a beautiful 8th century building. You know, it's the Golden Dome.
That's the thing you see. That's what you typically see. Yeah. That's not actually the mosque. That's the dome.
That's not the mosque. That's not the Al-Aqsa
mosque. I just wanted to clear that up very quickly. Yeah, that's the symbol. Yeah. That's what even Westerners that know about it.
You think of Jerusalem, you look at that. Beautiful building, you know, like, you know, Byzantine inspired.
Can I tell you a funny story about that? Now, I've never been to the Middle East of any type, or Israel or Jerusalem or anything, but I did when my first job when I first dropped out of college was, my boss was a Palestinian. Funny enough, he owned like this stereo company, and I was doing like, you know, graphic design and website stuff for them. He was interestingly born, he was married to an Iranian woman, funny enough, and he was from Ramallah. That was where he was born. And he told me, I remember one time he told me, he's like, yeah, no, I've been under the Dome of the Rock. And he's like, it's floating in the air. And I was like, there's a rock floating in the air. He's like, no, I was like, can I see a picture? And he was like, you can't take a picture of it. And I was like, okay. I left it as is. Cause I was like, I'm sure he believes
me. Yeah.
You know, I wasn't going to troll him on it too hard, but I was like, okay, all right. You know, I'm sure that people believe these things. So I just thought it was funny. Anyway. Yeah.
Yeah, no. I mean, like, if they believe, like, that stone is the foundation stone. You said he was married to an Iranian woman. That's not like common, but no, I see him. I see that.
Well, it was, I assume, like, they were rich. They were really rich. I mean, they, you know, one funny other story about him is, like, I was working there on 9/11 for him, and I didn't really think much about it. It was in suburban New Jersey. I didn't really think much about it, but in the graphic design / internet office of the company, which is me and like two other guys behind computers, like doing the website and all this shit, they had a big American flag on one wall. Like the day after 9/11, like Camel, we called him Hamel, we called him Camel. Like he comes in, he's like, I'm taking this, Habibi. He put it out in front of his house. And I was like, yeah, go ahead. It wasn't mine, but it's sort of funny. He's like, I'm taking this. I put this in front of my house because, you know, I'm going to have to defend myself. I don't know. It's pretty funny. Anyway. Yeah.
You said New Jersey. Like, what, was he in Paterson?
Nah, it was the town was called Tawako, which is part of like it's like I want to say it was like part of
I've never been
Morris Township. It was like Morris County. It was
Paterson is basically Little Palestine.
Yeah, no, he was rich, so he had like a mansion someplace. He was rich, and it was actually supposedly his wife's money. It was his wife's father who owned a group of stereo chains called Sabans. And not Sabans, Sammons. Sabans is something different. Sammons. So that was her name. And then he got one because he married her, and he opened this place called Sound City. Anyway, but they were very wealthy.
Collected the bag. Can't hate him.
I can't really hate the game, right? He played the game. But, like, it was just funny. We used to sell, right? He's like this greasy salesman type. Like, I was like, dude, he'll sell a bottle of ketchup to a lady with white gloves. Like, you know, it's like he's that type, right? He was that kind. That's like there's like a Semitic trope, if you will, that she absolutely fulfilled.
Yeah, I mean, listen, well, here's the thing. Like, for me, it's like I haggle everything. I mean, shoot, like I haggle $300.
Dude.
Well, not – I haggle $300 off my rent where I'm not going to –
dude.
Because, like, they –
funniest thing, we employees were supposed to get anything we wanted from the company at warehouse cost. So if he heard that you were going to buy something, you want to buy a TV or something for your car, it's like a car stereo or something like that, some speaker or something, he'd go to the computer, like up the price by like $20, like like he'd up like the warehouse cost of the thing by like $20 just so he could make $20 on this sale to his employee. So that was when like the other guys that were working there, like, don't go to Camel if you're gonna buy something, just come to me, I'll sell it to you. He does this shit. And I was like, okay, pretty funny. Anyway, whatever, just funny story. Just, I don't have any resentments about it. I just thought it was fucking funny as hell.
Shoot, man, like that semantic haggling and buying, it's a thing we do sometimes. But what I was going to say was, so 1929, you have the riots. Things start to really go into – and here's – excuse me. So in the whole people being pushed off their lands by the tens of thousands, this is one of the resentments that lead to the 1929 riots. You've got the Jews openly talking about destroying the Al-Aqsa compound. They're openly they're really openly talking about throwing out the Arabs. You have the Jews do a demonstration – at the Temple Mount, you know, or Haram al-Sharif, which is Arabic sanctuary. Mm-hmm. And then the Arabs do their own demonstration where they throw, where they kick Jews off the wall and they take the prayers out to a wall. And it's basically people fighting each other. Now, one of the catalysts of the riots is this. So there's a 17-year-old Jewish kid that's playing with a soccer ball. And then, and this is how the story that I read. He kicks it into this area yard, right? And then there's like the 7-year-old girl that plays with the ball, right? You know, she wants to play with the ball, but he wants the ball back. What happens is that she hides it under her dress, right? He kind of wants to get the ball back. He's trying to get the ball back. And then the girl's father and brother see the 7-year-old, like, you know, touching his daughter, and they beat the guy to death with rods. That's the story, right?
I'm pressing X, but like, you know, that's how innocently it started. But yeah, let's.
I mean, basically, what it is like, it is basically this: he wants the ball. The girl is like, you know, being a little kid. She hides it under her dress because, you know, she's a kid, and it's called the guy wants it back, and then the girl's father and brother.
Here's the thing, I'm just thinking of Jews reaching up a little girl's dress. Like, that's what I'm thinking.
I mean, this is the story that's told. I haven't heard anything counter that.
But it feels to me it's like Jews, you invented something so you can have an excuse why this Jew is reaching up this girl's dress. That's all I'm thinking. Because I'm like, what, he's 17, so interested in the soccer ball, he's 17.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
Not that you're not going to be, but it's not like he's another little kid.
Yeah.
You know, I'm thinking like this. Whatever happened to the ball? Did they ever produce the ball? Did we ever see that? Did that ever come? Was that ever in evidence?
Like, the story is that's the story. They think he's trying to molest the daughter, so they beat him to death. Right?
I'm going
to
go ahead and just believe him.
I haven't heard any other story to counteract that story. This is just what I heard. This is one catalyst. I mean, I honestly would be one to believe. Yeah, he just wants. That, you know, he was trying to be degenerate, as it were. I mean, like, because, like, really, like you can't just wait for the girl to be uninterested, or you can't just.
He can't. Why does he go? Why didn't he go ask her dad? Listen, your daughter has my soccer ball. Can I have it? Yeah. He's like, this is again. Look, I'm just gonna say, it seems awfully convenient story. Mm-hmm. And that we're told what we really have here is a Jew reaching up a little girl's dress, and that to me is just sounds like that's what was going on. One way or the other, we got that.
It's possible. And you have these small fights and these small riots and all that basically lead up to the Hebron massacre, right? Because the Irgun was doing shit, killing people as well.
Yeah.
Was them trying to prevent Arab workers, like you said, prevent Arab workers from working so that Jews would work those jobs. That's what they were. So that was the goal of what they were doing specifically.
Period are we in? Because we could go through the history of each riot and incident.
We're in 1929. I want to gloss over the Hebron riots. I want to talk about the...
But I think the point here being that, okay, so in broad strokes... We have the, just to sort of recap, like we have the, you know, the Arabs helping out the British in World War One, getting betrayed, promised their kingdom, briefly declared kingdom. It gets ultimately betrayed. The mandate system is put in effect. The French are given Syria, Lebanon, and British have mandate Palestine. This is then subject to civilian rule, not military rule, which then leads to actually this sort of issue where the British officers don't really like the Jewish settlement, but are forced to comply with orders from London, where every politician is under the sway of Jew bankers and Jew media and Jew Zionists and Jew influence. And so they keep pouring in. Riots erupt in the 1920, 1921, and the big ones in 1929. These are big famous ones. And so ultimately it's about, and Arabs are getting pushed off the land. Jews aren't necessarily using the land. These are Arabs who felt like they had a right to this land, even though they were tenant farmers, and their Ottoman landlords betrayed them. Nonetheless,
I mean, they've been living on that land from time immemorial.
Right. Nonetheless, I mean, you know, if you want to do a libertarian homesteading thing, like this was effectively, they were the owners of it. They were the ones transforming it through labor, whatever. The point being, like, you can understand their position and, then you just see that eventually they get the idea, okay, these Jews are not here, and whatever the pretensions of certain of the far left Jewish groups, like we're going to have, you know, a state of the Jews, Arabs, and the Soviet thing, which ultimately
this is what leads to the 1936, Great Revolt, because things are going badly enough that eventually the Arab Higher Committee, led by guys, Haji Amin al-Husseini, which if you know Ryan Gosling, dude literally looks like Ryan Gosling.
Yeah, right.
The Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, Haji Amin. saying you Google him, looks like Ryan Gosling.
No, he's very so Ryan, he's very base. Now, question about him though, because there is slander of him that goes on in certain left wing pro Palestine movements, and the slander is because of the fact that he did work with Nazis later on. And so this is something that the elements of the pro, which is something we're going to talk about later. And the claim is he's like that he himself was a colonial British official, that he was like actually there doing the work of the British. And now this would make
But everyone in the late 30s and early 40s met with Hitler. Like everyone had met with Hitler in the 30s at some point, you know. Hitler was like, oh, hey, I feel bad for you. I mean, you know, it's called like you obviously have these British and the Jews, blah, blah, blah. And so, well, he met with Hitler. Yeah, like everyone did, you know. I mean,
right.
National Socialism was actually in vogue, you know, it's called.
It was very popular. And yes, I'm not even trying to like apologize for him meeting with Hitler or anything like that. I do see that there is this attempt by some elements of the Palestinian movement to like disavow him, and then they say like, and then if because you know I got into an argument with some of these people recently, and I didn't even bring up Husseini. I didn't even bring him up. But I was just sort of telling them, like, you know, you guys always like leaping out to defend like Jews and like the Holocaust and all this stuff.
There's reason to criticize his leadership decisions. There's reason to criticize how he, it's called, decisions he made, right?
Sure.
But the claim is that he was a traitor.
You
met with the Nazis? Like, yeah, everyone fucking met with the Nazis. Who cares? Who cares that he met with Hitler? Everyone met with Hitler. Hitler was time of the was man of the.
Yeah, he was very important. But I'm just saying they slander him as like as and they were saying because they found out like what my political leanings were, and they're like, oh, next thing he's going to mention Haji Amin Husseini, and he's going to pretend like, you know, this British colonial official. It's like they're going to be like, yo, you're white supremacist, and they're accusing me now of white supremacy because I'm telling them that the issue is Jews, right?
And Avraham Stern and Yitzhak Shamir met with Avraham Stern at least met with Hitler, the Havara agreement.
But this is not about though. This was not about him meeting with Hitler. They were saying he was a British official.
There's a level of truth to this. Like it's not that Amin al-Husseini did not care, and it's not that Amin al-Husseini.
If you're going to work with the powers that are there at the time, right? Like,
He's the Grand Mufti. He's trying to balance the problem of being a colonial subject with the welfare of his people, while at the same time not trying to create, like, well, here's the thing. It was also like he wanted them gone out, but he had this trait that Arabs had of being slow and ponderous and trying to wait for the perfect moment to strike, right? To a point of where like you miss the opportunity and you don't even realize, right? And this was, and here's the thing, this critique that these had, that al-Qasim had. Izzeddin al-Qasim, right? The, you know, who's the namesake of the al-Qasim brigade. I'll tell you this, like, I mean, my every Palestinian will say, oh, my great-grand, he fought for al-Qasim personally, but al-Qasim only had like 1,000 guys, right? So everyone wants to say that for him. But a lot of Arabs did participate in the larger Arab British. But no, he was ponderous. He was a complicated man. Like he knew he wasn't unintelligent, but in many ways he was indecisive. The big problem on the ground is that he never really spoke to people. He was very insular, right? So he's not on the ground talking with people. He's not on the ground really making speeches, right? He's sort of keeping to himself. That's a problem with ponderous, missing opportunities, and just not really engaging with people. Also, his problem was a problem with the Arabs had in general. It's the fact that the different families hated each other, right? And the British exploited those hatreds. specifically the two biggest and most important families were the Husseinis and the Nashashibis. And the British exploited those Haitians by making Haj Amin the Grand Mufti, Haj Amin al-Husseini the Grand Mufti, and then they made, I think it was Raghib Nashashibi, the mayor of Jerusalem, right? And now you have these two major political factions at odds with one another instead of helping each other. But basically what happened is that in 1935, you have the first attempt at a revolt by a guy named Izzeddin al-Qasim, Muhammad Izzeddin al-Qasim. He was a Sufi imam, chaplain for the Turks during World War One. He was very disillusioned with the empire in the sense that they gave up Libya, Egypt, and he felt, well, if these were Turks, they wouldn't give him up that easily, right? And so he participates in some of the anti-French activity in 1921 when the French take control of the Mandate. But what he notices is a lot of the rich families in like Aleppo and Damascus, for all their talk, the French basically kowtowed them very easily, basically threatening their money, right? And they're like, oh, crap, I can't do anything. However, so he realized that the nobles and that the rich and the elites had no real heart in this. However, the poor were with him to the end in Syria, right? Because he wasn't born in Palestine. He was born on the coast of Syrian coast. But he moves downward to Haifa, and he's meeting with people, and he's organizing them. And he's going into these slums that peasants are being forced into. And these peasants, they're becoming alcoholics. They're drinking, they're going to the whorehouses. They're gambling, doing hashish, because that's just what happens when you live in.
Yeah. You are actually still cutting in and out severely now. It's very distracting. I'm going to go ahead and try to. I'm going to end the stream because I don't think you really need the visual stream of me. Maybe that'll fix some bandwidth issues. I don't know. We are still streaming, obviously, to the greater world. But do you want to take a quick break now? Because we're about an hour. We're like an hour and 40 minutes in. Maybe take 5 minutes.
What's it called? 5 minutes? I'm just going to go grab some water. I'll be right back.
Yeah. All right. I'm going to stop the recording. We'll start again when you come back. And so we'll be back in a minute, everybody, and we'll continue the narrative and hopefully fix the cutting in and out issue. So, yeah.